And once again, if you have your Bible, Deuteronomy 25. We're continuing in our study here in Deuteronomy. I'm sure we're all well aware of how the institution of the family is under attack these days. Frankly, when you look at how people live, as my old pastor used to say, people live like barnyard animals these days sometimes. It's a disgrace how people live. People live together without bothering to get married. People have children without bothering to get married. Children are being raised by single parents in many cases, which often leads to all manner of social problems. Some of these problems happen because people make sinful decisions, but other problems happen just out of really the providence of God. A tragedy happens. Somebody dies, for example, and leaves a widow or leaves a problem for other people to deal with. And so it's not so much sinful behavior or activity, it's simply the way that life happens in this sinful world. Well, Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 through 10, gives us some details about what Israel should do in a particular set of circumstances. A family tragedy has happened. A married man dies before he has the chance to have any children. Then the man leaves a childless widow behind. So what's to become of this widow? Well, Moses gives some directions here about what Israel can do in this kind of situation. Now, obviously, as we look at a text like this, as has already been mentioned, we look at this and say, well, how does this pertain to us? Or we recognize that this really doesn't have a common way of being fulfilled or being applied in our situation. But as we go through this and as we look at it, we do find some principles here, or we do find some ideas here that really are current today. Things that we can still apply in our families. Our families are very important to us. I trust that family life is very important to you. We should be focused in our lives on maintaining and strengthening our families. And so note several principles here that might be helpful for us in maintaining our family life. First of all, we find in verse 5 that tragedy sometimes happens. If brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, then the widow of the dead man shall not be married to a stranger outside the family. And it goes on to say what should happen. And so in this case, sadly, one of the brothers, one of who knows how many brothers, but brothers are dwelling together and one of them dies. He's a married man, and sadly, the woman has not had the chance, probably they've not been married long enough, for them to have children. And so the widow then is left without a husband and without children. And so these people notice that it's a certain situation. Brothers are dwelling together. Now, what does that mean? Are they just living in the same house? Are these blood brothers? Are these relatives? What are they? Well, it appears what this is talking about are people who are brothers, probably blood relatives, who are living together on the inheritance that they receive from their father. This would be the common land. Let's say you have three or four brothers. The father has died and they've inherited the land. So these people are working the family farm, you might say. Perhaps some of them are married, perhaps some of them are single, but you've got a set of brothers, we don't know how many, but one of them sadly dies before having children. He's married, but he did not have any children. Now, this pertains, it seems like, to brothers dwelling on this property by themselves or this property that they received from their father. But the Jews apparently applied this a little bit more broadly. We have a story in the Bible of somebody who married the sister-in-law or married the wife of a near relative who had died. And that story in the Bible, of course, is Ruth. And the fellow who did that was Boaz. Now, if you look at the story of Boaz, he was not the brother-in-law of Ruth's former husband. It appears as if there was a closer relative who did not marry Ruth. And that left the option for Boaz to marry Ruth, but he was not the brother-in-law of the woman. So they apparently applied it a little bit more broadly. He's called the near relative or the close relative of Ruth's former husband, but he's not exactly in this position. So it seems as if the Jews applied this a little bit more broadly than simply brethren dwelling together. However they applied it, the case is pretty obvious that this man died. He was married, and before he was able to conceive children, he died. This would have been a tragedy, certainly for the man and his family, his brothers, who were all working together on this plot of property. And it would, of course, have been a tragedy for the widow. Imagine this woman at this time. She's just been married, apparently, has not had any children, and then suddenly her husband dies. Childless widows in those days didn't have a lot of prospects for a happy life, especially if they couldn't go back to their father's house. As far as I know, there's no real government programs to help them other than what we've talked about previously with gleaning in the fields. That was almost the only thing that they had. So they would be potentially cast off out of the family, and they'd be on their own with no way of sustaining themselves. To be a childless widow in those days was really a very sad prospect. So Moses, in this case, gives a way of sustaining a lady, this widow, in this kind of circumstance so that she wouldn't be cast off into poverty. And so levirate marriage is a way of taking care of the widow by providing her with a spouse and potentially children. Well, the tragedy happens. Tragedies happen in most families. If you live long enough, you will suffer, or you will experience, you'll grieve over the loss of loved ones. Now, in my case, I'm old enough so that I've already grieved over the loss of my father and his three brothers. I've grieved the loss of my mother and her two brothers. In fact, all my aunts and uncles, other than one, have died, and I've grieved their loss. And many of you don't know what it's like, maybe especially some of the young people don't know what it's like to grieve the loss of a loved one, but if you live long enough, you're going to grieve the loss of many people in your life. And that's just part of life. That's part of the human condition. We live in a fallen world, and people die, and it's a tragedy, and we have to go on with life, and we have to do what we can do for the benefit of the person who has suffered. Even young people suffer tragedy. Even newlyweds suffer tragedy in some cases. Young women become widows. Suffering this kind of thing is sadly part of the human condition because we live in a fallen world. But even in this tragic situation, God provides for the widow. God provides for the family. They're suffering, they're grieving over the loss of this individual, but still there's hope for the future, potentially. If the people follow God's direction here, God's program for these people, there can be good that comes out of this. And so God cares about us when we suffer. God cares about tragedy. In our family situation, God provides what we need to get through the tragic situations of life. And so there is tragedy, but when tragedy happens, when tragedy strikes, secondly, in the second part of verse 5 here, "So the widow of the dead man shall not be married to a stranger outside the family. Her husband's brother shall go into her, take her as his wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her." Secondly, we find here that family cohesion is very important. Families need to stick together. Moses is saying, when this happens, don't just kick this lady, this girl, this widow out of your family. You should take some steps to keep her within the family. You want to keep that family together. Moses is concerned here that the widow would remain in the family into which she married and not be kicked out. She should not be married to a stranger. That would be somebody outside the family. She's been married into this group of brothers, into that specific family, and he wants her to retain her membership, you might say, there. She should not marry an outsider. Instead, her husband's brother, this would be her brother-in-law, the brother of the dead man, it says, should take her as his wife. Now, what if there was already a married situation? What if the oldest brother in this case were already married? Could a man who's already married take this woman as his wife? Well, yes. Under the Old Testament system, they did have arrangements. They did have the allowance for polygamy, having more than one wife. In fact, over in Exodus 21, it talks about if a man wants to take on a second wife. So, of course, we don't work things that way today, but back in the Old Testament, you find numbers of people who had more than one wife. And as we've talked about before, it usually didn't work out very well. But still, there was the allowance for taking on this other wife. He could do that. But most likely, as I've been reading and studying this passage, it seems like the Jewish tradition was that it wouldn't be the married man who would take on this widow as a wife. It would be, hopefully, the oldest unmarried brother. So you can imagine if there were, let's say, three or four men living together on the same property that they inherited from their father. They own this property jointly. One of them dies, but perhaps there's still one brother who's unmarried. And so generally speaking, according to the Jewish tradition, it would be the unmarried oldest brother who would fulfill this responsibility. He's called upon in this passage to fulfill that responsibility, but if we look at other passages, we find that this is kind of the exception to the rule. Because over in Leviticus 18, it specifically prohibits a man from marrying his sister-in-law. You're not supposed to marry the woman that your brother married. In fact, over in Leviticus 20, verse 21, Moses calls that kind of a marriage an unclean thing. So again, in this situation, we have kind of the exception to the rule. If brothers are not dwelling together or other circumstances pertain, then you can't marry your sister-in-law. But in this case, because the brothers are all living together, they're all co-owning this piece of property that they're working together as a farm, well then, the man is able to marry his brother's wife. This was the exception to the rule. He can do this when these particular conditions pertained. Well, God is good in that regard because sometimes we have situations in life. Life does not work out exactly the way that we had hoped. In other words, it's impossible for us to fulfill the ideal. Certainly we would want to fulfill the ideal in our lives, but there are times and cases in life where the ideal is not able to be fulfilled in our lives. We're not able to do exactly what we know that God would want us to do. The Bible says, God knoweth our frame. He remembereth that we are dust. And because of that, God makes accommodation for human tragedy. It's a sad thing that this tragedy occurred. But in order to take care of this widow, God is going to say, you can do something in this case that normally I wouldn't let you do. So God makes accommodations for our weaknesses. That doesn't mean there's an excuse for sin, but in some cases, God does accommodate so that we can do the right thing, even though normally we wouldn't be able to do that, but in certain cases, we can. Another example that I thought of that, kind of an accommodation to human weaknesses, is divorce. Divorce is not supposed to happen. Marriage is supposed to be permanent, but in certain cases, because of human sinfulness, because of bad decisions, because of life, well, divorce is allowable in some cases. So life for many people is just not going to be ideal. Bad things happen. People make bad decisions. Or life happens. Tragedy happens. And in those cases, there may be an accommodation God provides for us outside the ideal. God is merciful and gracious in spite of our faults and failures. There still may be a way of rescue. Even if we've made bad decisions in the past, even though we've committed sins in the past, there's still a way of doing the right thing. There's still a way of coming to a good conclusion, even if things have not been ideal in the past. And so what does God provide? I've called it levirate marriage. I don't know if you've heard that word before. Levirate is based on the Latin word for husband's brother, or brother-in-law is the levir in the Latin language, I'm told. And so this is called levirate marriage because the brother-in-law then takes the place of the dead husband. Well, family life is so important that God established a means of keeping the family together even after experienced a profound tragedy. Tragedy is uncontrollable. It happens to virtually everybody. We can't control the tragedies, but we can certainly control our response to the tragedies. And so families must pull together at a time of tragedy. Moses says, let's try to keep this family together. Let's not have this woman go out and marry a stranger. Let's try to keep the family together. We should support and encourage one another in difficult times. Take care of one another through the trials of life. The family needs to rally around and support at times like this in tragic circumstances. And then we find, thirdly, that children are important. Notice verse 6. It shall be that the firstborn son which she bears will succeed to the name of his dead brother, that his name not be blotted out of Israel. So the point of all this is to have a child, who would take the place of, essentially, the dead man. In the Hebrew community, children were very important. Children were the future. A man's child would inherit his property and hopefully enjoy all the blessings of God in the promised land. We're talking, of course, about Israel coming into the promised land and conquering that land and then setting up, you know, their communities, and hopefully enjoying all the blessings that God had promised to the people there in the promised land. So to have children to do that, to pass on your property, to pass on the inheritance, and allow or have these children to enjoy God's providence and God's blessing in the promised land, well, that was a very important thing. Failure to produce an heir was considered to be something of a disaster or a calamity. You would not want your name blotted out from Israel. You wanted to continue the blessings that God has given to your family. You want that to continue generation after generation. For a man to sit under his vine and fig tree with his family gathered around him was a wonderful prospect. To have generations succeeding you, to be there on the land, enjoying the blessings of God, that was the wonderful prospect that God had promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So to fail to do that, not have the next generation that can inherit, that can enjoy God's blessings in the promised land, that was a great tragedy and a calamity. The main reason for levirate marriage was so the firstborn son then could take the place of his dead father. And that would accomplish two things. It would allow the name of that man to continue on through history, so his name would not be blotted out. The first son born to the brother-in-law would then stand in place of his dead father. He would continue the family line for his father. So the name of the dead man would not be blotted out. And then the son would inherit the property. Remember, God wanted the property to stay within the family. They had that inheritance and they were not supposed to sell it. They were supposed to keep it. And so to keep that inheritance within the family was an important thing. So the procedure here that's given was not primarily for the benefit of the widow. Of course, she benefits because she's not just going to be cast off. She's going to be continually connected to the family of the man that she had originally married. So it's for the benefit of the widow, but the purpose really for this arrangement was so that the widow would produce a son, and then the son would stand in the place of his dead father, the man who had died previously. The son would then inherit everything that the father owned, and he would take eventually, the status of his father. So carrying on the family line or the family name, I think, is still important. I can't speak for anybody other than myself, but I think men generally want to continue on their family line after themselves. Now, for me, I don't have any sons, so the family name, I suppose my direct family name, is not going to continue after me. Unless my daughters marry somebody named Anderson, which around, you know, here in Wisconsin, that might be a definite possibility. But still, they'll get married. They'll probably take on somebody else's name, and my name, the Anderson name, will probably end, you know, with that. But they'll still continue, I hope. I don't know if I'll live long enough to see grandchildren. Maybe if they get married young, you know, then maybe I'll see grandchildren. But I hope to see the next generation. And, you know, just to enjoy the fact that, you know, our family is going on. And I think, I don't know, do most men look forward to that? Do you want to see your grandchildren and the prospects of your family line moving on to the next generations? I think most people want to see that. We should have an interest in future generations. We should be interested that our family prospers after our time. And I think most people, most men at least, I think want to hand down their inheritance to the next generation. Maybe not before we die, but you know, we're going to hand it down eventually. And that, I think, can be very meaningful. I think of when I'm working in my shop, I've got several tools that I got from my dad. And every time I use those tools, I open those toolboxes and I work on some of those machines and things, it reminds me of the legacy that I get from my dad. I have several things that my dad gave me that are around my home and around my shop. And so I'm kind of surrounded by, in certain ways, some of the things and some of the inheritance, some of the heritage, you might say, of my family, my dad and my mom. So that's a wonderful thing. I think that's part of the family experience, is passing these things down from one generation to the next. Of course, the only way we can do that is to have children. And I would encourage young people to get married and have children. We live in the kind of society today where sometimes couples get married and they don't want to bother with children. If they can both, you know, be working, they've got two incomes and they can live a wonderful life, they can travel, they can have all the luxuries if they simply don't have any kids. And so some couples, sadly today, they decide not to have children because that would kind of wreck their fun. Children are expensive. Children are inconvenient. Children are painful. So let's not have any. Well, that's not a Christian attitude. The right attitude to have is children are a blessing from the Lord. And blessed are those who have children. And so we want to encourage young people not only to get married, but also to have children so that you can pass on your inheritance, so that the family line can continue on. That's an important thing. Children are important. And then finally, lack of family loyalty is disgraceful. In verses 7 through 10, we have this procedure of what would happen if the man refuses to play the role of the husband's brother. So if the man does not, in verse 7, he does not want to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go to the gate to the elders and say, "My husband's brother refuses to raise up a name to his brother in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother. Then the elders of the city shall speak to him, call him and speak unto him. But if he stands firm and says, 'I do not want to take her,' then the brother's wife shall come to him in the presence of the elders, remove his sandal from his foot, spit in his face, and answer and say, 'So shall it be done to the man who will not build up his brother's house.' And his name shall be called in Israel, the house of him who had his sandal removed." Okay, so there's this long procedure, and Moses then describes what should happen or what potentially might happen if this man refuses to take up his brother's wife. He might want to avoid this responsibility. Perhaps he doesn't like the woman. He knows the woman. The woman has lived with his brother. He just doesn't like her. She's unattractive. She's unappealing. She's unpleasant, whatever the thing is, but he doesn't want to live with this woman. Perhaps the marriage would be an economic burden. Maybe this guy doesn't have a lot of money, and marrying this woman would be an economic burden. Perhaps he doesn't want to complicate his own relationships. Maybe he's already married, or maybe he's already got his eye on another girl. In this case of Boaz and Ruth, you may remember that there was a closer relative, and that closer relative had the option of marrying Ruth, but he didn't want to because he said it would complicate his own family relationships. So he declined, and that's the only reason that Boaz was able to marry her. So, there may be various reasons. Moses doesn't give the reason why he doesn't want to. He just simply says, if the man does not want to take his brother's wife. Okay, so no reason given here, but he just doesn't want this woman. So this responsibility is expected of the man, but not absolutely required. He should marry this widow, but if he absolutely refuses, well, then he doesn't actually have to. If the man refuses this obligation, there's a certain procedure then to carry out. And so Moses tells the woman and the family what should happen. There's a moral obligation here, a moral expectation of this man. But if he refuses, well, then here's what's going to happen. The widow then exposes her brother-in-law to shame and disgrace. So it says in verse 7, the brother's wife goes to the gate to the elders and says, "My husband's brother refuses to raise up the name to his brother in Israel." Okay, so in the gate of the city, that's the place where the people of the city, the leading men, the elders, would conduct business. And archaeologically, they found these gates to these various cities. And typically in the gate or along near the gate, there would be rooms. And people would conduct business of various kinds, public and private business, at the gate of the city. And again, going back to the story of Boaz and Ruth, that's what Boaz did when he wanted to marry Ruth or buy that property, was he went to the gate of the cities and talked to the elders. So in this case, they're supposed to bring this guy to the gate to the elders, and the woman then charges or makes an accusation that this man will not do his obligation. And so it says then the people of the city, the elders of the city, then talk with this man and try to convince him to do what he ought to do. They verify the fact, yes, the man is refusing to do this obligation. And apparently they talk to him. It says in verse 8, they shall call him and speak to him. And the sense I think there is they try to convince him to do what he ought to do. This is a moral obligation. This is expected. This is tradition. This is right. And why aren't you doing this? They try to convince him. But it says, if he stands fast, he stands firm and says, "I do not want to take her." Okay, there's something there, some specific thing that makes him say, "No thanks, I'm not interested in marrying this woman." He's standing fast to his commitment or to his conviction that he doesn't want this woman. So they've tried to convince him, he refuses, and if he's stubborn in his refusal, then the widow here, verse 9, his brother's wife shall come to him in the presence of the elders, and do this little procedure. Take his sandal from his foot, spit in his face, and then say, "So shall it be done to the man who will not build up his brother's house." Spitting in one's face, as you can imagine, was a very serious insult, especially back in those days. It was a disgraceful act, an act of contempt and shame. The widow is showing here that this man is shameful. She's kind of demonstrating the shame and the disgrace of this man by spitting in his face. And so this was a very insulting thing, but it shows the disgracefulness of this man, the shame of this man in refusing to do what he should have done. And then taking off the sandal signified that the man refused to fulfill his obligation. He's exposed as one who did not care about his extended family. He's a disgrace. Servants and slaves walked around with no shoes. So to take the shoe off the man's foot or his sandal would be sort of like saying, you're the lowest of the low. Slaves and servants were the lowest standing, you know, the lowest status people in the land. And so to take off the shoe is essentially saying, you are very low status. You're a disgrace. He should be ashamed of himself. And then the charge, of course, here, here's one who will not build up his father's house. The brother-in-law should build up his father's house or his brother's house by providing the heir that would retain the dead man's name and property. Building up the brother's house, he's died. But we can do something to take care of this man, take care of the widow, and he refuses to do that. He refuses to build up the brother's house. So on top of the tragedy of the man's death is the further tragedy that the brother could not be relied upon to take care of this issue, to do what he could do to build up his brother's house. So this would have been a very serious charge. The man lacked loyalty to his family. He's a disgrace to his family. He didn't care about the health and welfare of his brother's family. He cared more about his own concerns, and maybe he had legitimate concerns, but at this point, he should have fulfilled his obligation. He should have fulfilled his responsibility. He cared about his own responsibilities or concerns more than he cared about his brother. So this makes him a contemptible and shameful person who deserves public humiliation. And so in verse 10, it says, his name shall be called in Israel the house of him who had his sandal removed. Again, to go barefoot is a disgrace in that culture at that time. And so this is a very shameful and humiliating act for this man to have gone through with. And notice this, the house of him, not just the individual, but now his house or his household has this stigma now from now on that he's a disloyal person. He refused this responsibility. It was a great humiliation and a disgrace for the one who refused it. Well, again, our situation is considerably different from this kind of situation that we find as we read in Deuteronomy. But as you think of how people disgrace their families today, in our present context, many people behave disgracefully as it pertains to family life. They live together without being married sometimes. It's a disgrace when people get divorced without biblical grounds. It's a disgrace when parents refuse to discipline their children. It's a disgrace when children fail to obey and honor their parents. It's a disgrace when parents fail to bring up their children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. So perhaps the disgrace that is talked about here is not exactly the same as what we would experience or encounter. But still, we have family responsibilities. And when we fail to engage those responsibilities, when we refuse those responsibilities, it's a disgraceful thing. It can bring disgrace to our families. We don't have a ritual like this, but certainly we should feel the shame of failing to meet our obligations when it comes to our family. People sometimes have little or no loyalty to their family. They don't care about the other members of the family. They behave disgracefully and bring disrepute upon their family. And obviously, that's something Christians should not do. We should strive to fulfill our family obligations, and that will help and strengthen our families. Well, obviously, this teaching on levirate marriage does not pertain to us directly. We don't practice levirate marriage today. Young women, unlike the widow in this case, young women today have many options. There's lots of different forms of support for a woman like that. She doesn't necessarily have to marry her brother-in-law. We don't conduct family business in public. We don't spit in anyone's face, at least not on purpose, hopefully. And we don't pull off anyone's shoe. I mean, what would be the meaning of pulling off a shoe in our culture? It just doesn't have that same meaning for us. However, we still do have family relationships, and we should still try to strengthen and maintain these family relationships. And we do that primarily by fulfilling our responsibilities. This man simply refused to fulfill his family obligations, and that's what makes him shameful. That's what makes him a disgrace. We all have family responsibilities, and we have to fulfill them, even if it might be a sacrifice. Probably this man didn't want to marry this woman because it would be a sacrifice. He didn't want to do it for his own intents and purposes. But family relationships are somewhat difficult, and sometimes we have to fulfill our obligations, even if it is a sacrifice. Marrying this widow would have probably been something of a sacrifice for this man, but he should have made that sacrifice for the benefit of his family. Well, if you and I fail to fulfill our family relationship responsibilities, that's a shame. That's a disgrace. We're failing to build up our brother's house. We're failing to do our part for the health and welfare of the family. It's unlikely that anyone is going to pull off your shoe or spit in your face. But it certainly would be true if we behave disgracefully, that is, we behave disgracefully by failing to build up our brother's house, failing to do what we should have done in our family relationships. After your relationship with God, your relationship to your family is of next greatest importance. Okay? Being rightly related to God, that's the primary thing. But the family relationships, that's a very close second. Being rightly related to your family is a very significant thing. And so don't disgrace your family by shameful conduct. Fulfill your family relationship responsibilities. Build up your brother's house. Your family will thank you for it. Let's close in prayer.